The content here is for informational purposes only, should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security, and is not directed at any investors or potential investors in any A16Z fund. For more details, please see a16z.com/disclosures.
Hi, this is Chris Dixon. This is the A16Z podcast. I'm here with Benedict Evans. Let's talk about, so a lot of people are talking about ad blocking lately. iOS 9 allows you to download ad blockers or content blockers, which are mainly ad blockers. I guess the first question I have is this, there's a lot of talk about it. Is it actually a big deal?
It's an interesting one. I think that there's several ways you can look at that. One is obviously the majority of time spent online on a smartphone actually isn't inside the web browser. Mm-hmm. It's inside Facebook and it's inside other apps.
This would also, though, presume, does it affect it when you're in the web view?
Well, so yes and no. Yeah. If you implement the new, faster, cooler web view, then it's affected. But if you're actually just looking at stuff actually in your newsfeed, then obviously it's not. But if you tap on a link and they implement the web view, then it's affected.
A lot of content is viewed that way.
Yeah. So there's that kind of wonky question, well, how much content is this affected by? Then there's how many people are going to install these things. And right now, you know, clearly you're going to have a surge of people who really care about this stuff. It's always seemed to me that there's kind of several different – there's a portion of people who really, really get upset about tracking. And I'm not sure how broad a percentage of the overall population that is. And then there's another percentage of people that get really, really upset about the principle of advertising. And again, I'm not sure how many people that is. The interesting thing on mobile, I think, is that the actual, just the amount of code and the amount of JavaScript and ad tech stuff that's happening actually slows down your experience. So there's actually like a real user benefit as opposed to like a kind of a theoretical benefit to installing this stuff.
I mean, I've always assumed it's just sort of the power of defaults here, which is if Apple were to make this the default, that it stripped out advertising, that would be a big deal. If it requires people to go and download a special thing, and it's actually quite wonky right now, you have to go in, or Kludge, you have to go in the settings and install it. Yeah, like 10% of the 5 to 10% typically do things like that that aren't default. Mm. And those 5 to 10% are probably, you know, in their basement screaming at the computer, and like they're the types who don't buy stuff anyways. And I don't know. So like, is it actually going to affect?
So I think like the kind of high watermark here would be Google Maps on iOS, which has something like 100 million active users, mm-hmm. out of maybe 450 million iPhones. And I think that gives you a pretty good indicator
for the power of defaults.
Yeah, here is like an actual really, I mean, it's not like Apple.
Google Maps is a vastly better product. Yeah, and yet your point is that only 100 million people use what is clearly a vastly better product.
Only a quarter of the base have installed it. I wouldn't say it's vast. I mean, it's like Apple Maps isn't terrible and most people don't use it that much.
It's not bad until it tells you to drive off of a bridge. Or
whatever. Most people don't use maps that much. Most people don't actually care that much. And there you are, even where that's a quarter of the base. So how many people will install this and then how much does it flow through? I mean, there's a kind of a broader kind of set of questions here around, well, as a publisher, is advertising really sustainable anyway? Is this just like a catalyst for saying, you know what, screw this stuff, this isn't working very well? How do you get read? You know, should you be thinking about micropayments? Should you be circling back on apps? Should you be thinking about other ways to get distributed? And so, you know, at the same time as Apple launched this, obviously they launched their Apple News aggregation app, and then you have Facebook doing inside the Facebook
app. Like one argument, which I think I believe, is it's a diversion to worry about what's happening in Safari when the real ad blocker is called Facebook, right? Yeah. And it's not that they actually block the ads. It's that the stuff, if they want your stuff to get shown pretty soon, you're going to have to use Instant Articles.
Yep.
And Instant Articles is not going to let you show your ads. I mean, it's going to, if they're not native ads. And that's what, you know, in some ways, that's what you should, you know, if you're a publisher, you should keep your eye on that ball, not the,
If half your traffic, half your traffic is on Facebook, then Facebook's already going to be blocking your ads. So, you know, this other stuff doesn't matter. Yeah, I mean, I mean,
in some ways, Facebook is the new browser. It's the new RSS reader, and it's the new ad blocker all combined into one. And what's happening in Safari with plugins is a sideshow.
I think that's right. I mean, there's a kind of – I wrote a blog post the other week kind of starting with a chart of the traffic to my blog, which now gets like 100 to 200 to 300,000 views a month depending on what I've written about. But – I started in 2010. For the first 3 years, I basically got 100 views a month or 200 views a month. And the point of that is, it's like, yes, you can write stuff. You could write stuff in, you could code the stuff in Notepad and put it on an FTP server. But actually, you're going to get, what you want is to get read. And if you want to get read, you've got to be in some kind of a platform that's giving an audience. And increasingly, that means Facebook, or it means Medium, or it means LinkedIn, or it means some other intermediate platform that kind of comes with an implicit ad blocker, a revenue model, a filter, some other set of stuff that comes between you and your audience, which is always like the problem for newspaper for big publishers looking at Facebook. It's like it's a kind of a deal with the devil issue that they can give us traffic, but they it comes on their terms.
So a lot of the ad blocking discussion has then led people to say, well, what if it's not, you know, does this mean we should be thinking about different advertising models for, you know, for example, for newspapers, et cetera.
Or micropayments.
Yeah, and that leads to the discussion of micropayments, which we were discussing, and actually what triggered this podcast was a discussion with startup L. Jackson, a fictional Twitter character who apparently dictates what we discussed.
I can't believe Mark has time to tweet under two characters at the same time.
No comment. So startup would like us to talk about micropayments. So you I think, are skeptical of micropayments?
Well, I'm not skeptical. It's just we've seen 15 years of people wishing that you could do this, yeah. And the frictional barriers to having one platform on every site, having people enter their credit card, having some sort of identity platform that would make it work. It's always been one of those things that's like, if we'd had the information superhighway instead of the internet, and it had been built by, you know, AT&T and people like that, and it was like a system that happened on your TV, then yes, you'd have micropayments. But, you know, in fact, we have this permissionless, you know, completely open, defragmented environment, and it's really hard to make something like that work. I mean, when Apple launched the iPad and things like Newsstand, people thought you were going to be able to do micropayments on the iPad, and everyone was going to make an app on the iPad, and everyone was going to read stuff in there, and there'd be micropayments and subscriptions, and it kind of didn't work for a whole bunch of reasons. And I think the question would be, it's like, it's easy to say you should be able to bill 1 cent for each article or 10 cents for each article, but getting that frictionless payment platform in there and having everybody use it has just been too hard so far. That's not to say it won't be, but...
So you walk around New York City and you have these little sort of small casual payments. And actually, if you read, it's always worth reading like the original Bitcoin paper. There's a lot of discussion around Bitcoin, but the original paper is actually, first of all, extremely well written, very interesting. Yep. From a technical perspective, but also the first paragraph is very clear about what the point is. It's small casual payments is the point, right? So you walk around New York City and I am late to a meeting and I go to a street vendor and I buy a cup of coffee. I don't want to have a long-term relationship with that vendor. I don't want to fill out a form. Mm. It's very useful to give the guy whatever it costs now, $2 for a cup of coffee.
Well, $6.50
for the Rosewood. Maybe these days. But, you know, it's very useful. Cash is a very useful way to make small casual payments, for example, walking around a city, right? So the argument is it would be great to have that online. And so, and I'll give you a practical example. Spotify, in many ways, is a payment bundler. You could imagine if we were to start over today with the entire music industry and everything else starting from scratch, how would you architect music service? Well, you might architect it where, put $10 into my browser and it charges me every month. And then my browser tells me, my music browser, whatever it might be, it looks at what music I listened to that month. And then it divvies up my $10 and pays it directly to the artist. And there's no label and there's no Spotify. And it's a relationship between me and the artist. And, you know, this sort of Clay Shirky argument that no one will ever adopt micropayments because of the mental friction. That I think is based on what I think is a flawed assumption that micropayments presumes that a human is deciding every single time you pay something.
Well, they have to look like micropayments. If they look like micropayments, it might be one thing. But if you can package it in some other way.
Well, and I think that's – I mean, I always assumed – I guess I always, for me, micropayments always meant the infrastructure supported small casual payments. So two entities could make a transaction of a small amount without incurring transaction fees that make it prohibitive and without having to have an ongoing relationship the way you currently do with a credit card and without having a 20% chargeback rate and like all these other and like the charge denials. And so you had a way to – you had sort of internet cash, right? And you could make small cash payments. There's no reason that can't be software assisted, that you can't have – you know, bots and other things assisting how you divvy out those micropayments. There's no reason a human has to be saying, let me decide who to give 10 cents to and 10 cents to. Those are two – that would just be an old-fashioned architecture to me to have a human making those decisions. So to me, the argument that sort of a human will never want to – you know, the mental cost of making the decision, that's just a very old-fashioned assumption that there's a human deciding how everything's done. Architecturally, it seems to me that having the ability to have sort of something the equivalent of cash – low transaction costs, no ability to have fraud, not having to have an ongoing relationship between the two entities, would be a very useful architectural thing. Bitcoin is one very promising example of that. There could be others. The existing credit card system seems extremely flawed. PayPal's extremely flawed. I mean, the way PayPal deals with many issues is they simply block about half the world from transacting, right? I mean, there's a on eBay, 20% of all international transactions are blocked because the way they deal with the fact that their system is not built for the internet is they tune the algorithms to just block almost everything that looks remotely suspicious, right? It's if you submitted PayPal to your CS101 class as your ideal payment system, you'd fail out of the class.
PayPal must have been complete idiots, you know.
Well, no, I mean, look, PayPal is a great, you know, they're obviously smart people, but the point is it was an extension of the credit card system, which was built for a different era. It was not built for this. It simply wasn't built. These things were not built for the kind of the way the modern internet works, I would argue.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is sort of observation, like Mark likes to point out, that it's the what is it, 403?
402. Yeah, well, this is the...
There's no payment, there's also no identity. And I think there's
so this is the error code 404 is no web page. There's also an error code 402 built in HTTP spec, which is payment required. And you're saying the identity is
nothing, except that we never
And I believe, so you go back to, you rewind to 1993, and you had different possible futures of the internet, right? And one possible future, you had built identity and you had built payments into it. And to me, that would have been I mean, I love the internet and it's awesome. And thanks to Mark and all these other great people who did it. And I'm not complaining and looking a gift horse in the mouth. That said, rewinding it would have been really nice to have built identity and payments in the first place.
So my first job, like I think in 99, I joined an investment bank.
Yeah.
And I think in my first week, I was sent along to sit at the back of the room in the IPO drafting session for a company called Trintech, which makes chip and pin payment terminals. And they were one of the companies behind something called SET. And the idea of SET was it was basically an escrow system for your credit card. So your browser had your credit card, but the e-commerce site never got your credit card. It was kind of passed through, you know, like a kind of tokenization.
It's actually kind of how Apple Pay works.
Exactly. It's exactly how Apple Pay works, yeah. And of course, they...
Which is, by the way, a far better system. You don't the credit card system, you hand the password over.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is just...
SET,
you would literally fail out of class if you submitted that in a project.
Exactly. Like, it is the worst architecture. This was SET. This was like 98, 99. And this was like the idea for how you were going to get people to be comfortable putting their credit cards in. And it turned out that the answer was you just put your credit card in and the credit card companies eat the fraud costs and PayPal blocks half the transactions and so on. So you just deal with it that way. But you know, to your point, if you could... There's always this sort of, I mean, it's what you say about going back to 1992. We kind of look at what happened and we presume it's inevitable. And we look at all the micropayment things that failed and presume, well, that's just because micropayments aren't going to work. Just like, you know, we look at the failure of the portals in America and think, well, portals didn't work. You look at China, portals did work. And a lot of the things that look inevitable as failures, that's just kind of how it turned out. Yep. And the technology didn't quite work out like that. And it's certainly possible that we could have, you know, whether it's Bitcoin or something else, a micropayment system of some kind or a subscription system of some kind that did work. The challenge is always like, well, how do you get everyone to adopt
it's
the thing and all
problem.
The publishers to
the
adopt
chicken
the thing?
Problem. It's a massive, massive, it's the mother of all chicken and egg problems, right? It's like, it's the big chicken and egg problem. Yeah. It's the biggest one of all.
And the thing that comes in parallel is you have Facebook or BuzzFeed or Medium creating, solving it from the side. So Facebook has both the distribution and the business model for third parties. Well, the business model for themselves, the distribution for third parties, and BuzzFeed has the distribution and the business model for themselves, and Medium right now has distribution for third parties, but no revenue model, although presumably that will come. And I thought it was interesting just to look at, you know, how BuzzFeed in particular comes at this, going right back to advertising and ad blocking, in that what they haven't done is kind of slap a banner ad as invented by Wired in about 1996 or 1997 and put 10 meg of JavaScript on the back of it to try and work out who the hell you are, which is my point about identity. Is the reason the advertising is 10 meg of JavaScript is because they don't know who you are and they want to have some vague sense of who the hell you are to show you so they know what kind of ad to show you. Whereas if you're BuzzFeed or if you're Facebook, you have that identity because it's in the Facebook profile. If you're BuzzFeed, you build native advertising. You build advertising.
Well, and the native advertising is inherently... The identity is built in by who shares it.
Exactly.
Right. So the person who likes cats shares it with another person who likes cats, and that targeting, quote unquote, is happening by humans, not by
So you're not cookies. Building 10 meg of kind of crappy JavaScript to try and guess as to who this person is. It's actually inherent in the product. And that's actually also a much better revenue model. And so it may be that, you know, you come at this from that other angle, which is you build it as a single site. You solve it as Medium. You solve it as Facebook. You solve identity as Facebook rather than OpenID.
Well, to that point, like, you know, one way to look at this is you go to the New York Times, and it's, you know, New York Times is a you know, it's a beautifully, you know, from a journalism perspective, it's an amazing product, right? It's great writing. They spend tons of money on research. And so you're looking at, you know, if you go to just a desktop web and you go to the New York Times, you're looking at the page of the text, and you've got an A-plus product. And then you look around the text, and you've got literally, like, I have screenshot. I always screenshot whenever I see these kinds of ads. It's like the Tahiti diet or teeth whitening, right? It's the lowest of the low, crappy ads, like sitting around on these banners, which I guarantee you on mobile, if there are any clicks on those ads, I bet you 95% of them are fat thumb, fat finger accidental clicks. Like, nobody is willing. Like, the odds of somebody reading an article about, you know, whatever, something, you know, foreign policy in the New York Times, and then clicking on a Tahiti diet, I'm sorry, that is not that it's an, if it's happening,
well,
it's actually,
well, banner ads are like Yahoo. It's like, you know, that hundreds of millions, yeah, of people must be clicking on them, but you've never met anyone who does it.
But they don't. I don't know. So I would just say this, that you have, if you just look at it through the lens of product development, you've got, on the one hand, a great product, you know, not the Economist, they don't do it. Well, they have banner ads, I think.
They have ads, yeah.
Whatever. You have the Journal, the FT, the Economist, the New York Times, all of these first-rate journalistic institutions with top-rate journalistic products bundled with very third-rate monetization products. And then people say, oh my gosh, digital monetization doesn't work. We're trading analog dollars for digital pennies. Now, there's two ways to look at that. One is, there's something magical about a computer screen that makes it less monetizable. The other is, perhaps you've aligned yourself with a business model that is just a very low quality product. So that would be, by the way, the BuzzFeed perspective. And yeah, like, and that people have this, I think, this very, they misunderstand what native advertising are ads that people actually like, right? This is the goal of native advertising. This is native advertising done right. It's ads, like, it's sort of like Super Bowl ads or something.
Well, the TV advertising industry has always known this.
Of course it is. Yeah,
ads people like.
You make ads people like, and in the social web, people will share them. As opposed to, you know, thinking of what the publishing industry has been, I think, kind of misled or down the wrong path of thinking of it as, like, you have the hamburger and you have the spinach and you have to take the spinach with the hamburger or whatever. I don't know.
I think there's an interesting thing implicit in all this is what happened with paywalls.
Yeah.
Is, as soon as with the newspapers that went to paywalls, and particularly like hard paywalls, mm-hmm, like the Times, as opposed to the New York Times, where the Times you have to pay, that's it, you can't read anything.
You mean the London Times?
The Times, the New York Times is named after.
The London Times. Okay,
actually the Times.
That's that country in that European
so,
country.
So the point is that when those newspapers did that, the site experience got way, way better, because all the crap advertising disappeared,
yeah,
all the link bait headlines disappeared, all the Taboola and the click on 500 other stuff disappears. You get white space on the site because all of a sudden they don't have to do that anymore. And it feels like you could kind of do like a 2x2 matrix, like a kind of a Gartner 2x2 matrix of, you know, traffic versus value or whatever the mm-hmm. axis would be. And like, in one corner you would have The Guardian, which is trying for massive global scale with no monetization worth speaking of. And in the other corner you would have The Daily Mail, which is got the same traffic, a tenth of the cost base, and a tenth of the content quality, and the rail of shame and everything else. And in another corner, you would have like the Times, the Financial Times, the Economist, where it's like pay or go away in some sense. And the New York Times to some extent as well. You kind of got to pay them if you want to read the New York Times every day. And then in the other corner, maybe you have BuzzFeed, which is no, let's just actually take, instead of having a vast audience and just throwing we don't know what at it and hoping that we'll make it up, let's actually think natively about what money revenue on the free internet looks like.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? You've got these kind of these different axes of quality versus.
Well, you know, the big.
Traffic.
I mean, for me at least, the big, the great monetization epiphany on the internet was Google, right? Like, the first time you saw. It just, the assumption had always been that you had to, you know, you had the carrot and the stick. The carrot was the product, and the stick was the monetization.
Well, it's
and Google
story.
Said no. I mean, the ads are actually quite useful. Like, it turns out that in many cases, those are as relevant or more relevant than the organic listings.
Well, it's the best story is, you know, the I can't remember who it was that they were trying to license their product to in the very early days. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I don't want to use the search engine to be too good because people will leave.
This was, I think, Excite or something. They were trying to sell the company.
Yeah.
And they tried to sell it for $1 million.
Your results are too good because people will leave the site, so we won't make any money.
Well, remember, at the time, it was all around stickiness
yes.
was the thing. So you had to keep
them. Eyeballs.
Search was well known to be a bad business, and portals was a good business. So you had to – search was a way to get them into your portal where you then show like celebrity gossip and then banner ads. And that's why Yahoo actually outsourced their search to Inktomi and others. So that's a good cautionary tale.
Well, so it struck me when you talk about finding new models, it's like, in a sense, it's not that it's easy for BuzzFeed, but, you know, BuzzFeed can do that. If you're a top 10 site, you can think about doing that. If you're the next 10,000 sites, you know, once upon a time, you'd say, well, we're going to have to sell our banner ads, and that was a nightmare. And then you have ad networks, which kind of act as a natural intermediary. So is there an ad network for native advertising in some sense? You know, how do you reach a point where everyone can be doing good advertising as opposed to only the people who've got a big team of geniuses to work it out?
It's a good question. I think it's TBD. We don't know the answer. I think it's one way to look at BuzzFeed is every media company has a point at which the advertising and the content interact. The way that it worked historically was they interacted in the news world, let's say, is they interacted through physical adjacency, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, you put the article on the page and you put the ad next to it, and that happened on paper and it happened on the web.
TV.
And TV, it's temporal adjacency, right? Yeah. It's like, you know, you have this slice and that slice. The idea with BuzzFeed is you have the adjacency actually comes in the layer of the creation and the data. So you have lots of data and learning, and that is the sort of the center of the system, and that informs both the publishing side and the advertising side, and that's where the quote bundling happens. It doesn't happen in the articles appearing next to ads, because the assumption from the start was that the internet will unbundle those things. They will unbundle the ads from the content.
You can't understand BuzzFeed if you go to buzzfeed.com because
that's a very small portion of the experience and not really how it works. You understand it when you go to it through a social network and you see, because basically ads have now become unbundled from, like, the only place that ads are being bundled with content is in the platforms. Right,
yep.
It's in Facebook, it's in Twitter, and it's in native ads, and they will be the new ad networks in many ways. Right, their ad networks, like this ad tech industry, unfortunately, I think will mostly go away. Banner ads, et cetera. It will be Google. It will be things in streams. They will. Facebook knows who the person is.
So is ad tech the new search? Or the search industry before Google.
You're saying people are mistakenly outsourcing it, it will come back and be a good thing?
Well, in a kind of like a more general sense, that there were all these people doing not very good search, and then Google came along with a completely different way of doing search. There will be like a similar kind of a nuclear bomb that hits the ad tech industry.
I think it's happening now, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I believe. I mean, and also, if you just look at like the public ad tech company stock prices,
no, and 50% of traffic is bots and fraud.
And so I think it's happening now. You know, for me at least, that said, I think the publishing industry, once it's going through this kind of turmoil now, will end up being stronger than ever because you've got, what is the number now, 3 billion people with smartphone internet access going
to... 2.5 with smartphones going to probably 4, maybe 4.5.
Yeah, 4.5. I mean, like the scale. So, you know, even if you assume the worst case that you reduce monetization by, what, a factor of 10 or even 100, the scale of reach here will go up by at least that much. If you consider in the past a regional newspaper or something can now reach soon, what, the entire, probably, what, 6 billion people by 2020? I don't know what you're projecting.
Well, there's 5 billion adults on Earth. Probably there's probably 2.5 billion smartphones now that will go up to 4 billion. But, you know, a lot of those are farmers in rural Africa. So
and it's a multiplier effect, right? It's not only is it... is it number of people? It's the amount of time spent.
Yeah, it's the time spent.
It used to be at best, right? Like you would, like someone who, a very engaged newsreader might spend 45 minutes in the morning reading the news, and that was it. Mm. Now it's a constant thing throughout the day. It's deeply integrated. If you look at what's happened with Facebook, I mean, you know, they, it's now, news not only is something you consume, it's the thing you talk about with your friend. You know, it's part of your social experience on the web, right? It's like that's a lot of what BuzzFeed's insights are as well, is that they're not just things to read passively. They're things to then share and discuss. And so the amount of time spent on news and on media and the number of people with access to it is, you know, I think, like, if you add up sort of, if you multiply those two times each other, it's like 1,000x. It's very, very promising. And I think just this, we just need to figure out in this transition period what the best models are, and there will be some shakeout. But the good journalists and writers and content media creators will do very well in that new world.
Yep.
Okay, thanks.
Great, thank you.